Neil Wilkins, and welcome to the Mindful Living Show. I'm joined today by Ollie Francis from Deck Chairs. Ollie has many, many years' experience in the concept of UX, and we're here to explore today the topic of mindful UX and whether or not it exists, whether it can be used, and kind of what's in it for us. So welcome, Ollie.
Hi, Neil. Yeah, thank you for inviting me onto the podcast. It's a subject very close to my heart at the moment, so really, really happy to be invited on.
I think it's going to be really interesting because it is one of these things that feels like it's a little kind of an amorphous evolution of a concept. I mean, UX obviously has been with us for decades now as people have kind of almost created an industry out of it. But I think it's kind of, to me, it's kind of evolving into something a little bit more sort of purposeful, a little bit more mindful, dare we say it. So I'm really interested to kind of explore that with you. For people who don't know you at this point, give us a little bit of a background as to kind of how you came to being in UX and kind of what you're sort of getting involved in right now.
Yeah, sure. So my background is in design. And I started years and years ago in IT, actually, and then quickly kind of came into being into contact with the design world through web design and the infancy of the internet. And what I found actually was that the internet was this sort of perfect combination of creative and technical, which is something that I really like, the sort of two sides of my brain, if you like. And I formed Deck Chair about nearly 20 years ago now, and I started working with my business partner, Becky Taylor, about 15 years ago. And we run a consultancy, so Deck Chair is a consultancy based in Bristol. And in the last 5 or 6 years, we've become almost exclusively focused on UX in the digital sphere. And the clients that we tend to work with are membership organizations. So anyone with subscribers, members, repeat customers, we find that we can add an awful lot of value there because the premise of UX really is to, which I'll come on to, is to improve and really make things user-centered. And part of that UX process is iteration. You know, you want to continually improve things. We work for all sorts of people over the years, corporations, large, small companies, but we tend to now work in the third sector predominantly. So NHS, government like gov.uk, Reading University, as well as some other corporate clients still. And we also run a course. So over the last 3 or 4 years, we realized really that we were more and more coaching our clients. There was more of a need with our clients for their internal teams to learn UX process. And what was born naturally out of that was that we started thinking about how do we teach this? How do we bottle up our knowledge? And we were approached by a company in Bristol called Develop Me to create a UX training course, which we've now run for the last 3 or 4 years, which basically largely takes designers, people who've come from the graphic design world or web design world, and gives them UX skills. One of our sort of underlying beliefs, or one of the things that drives me, and this comes through to the whole mindful thing, I guess, is that I really do want to work on projects that improve the world. Something that can sound a bit trite sometimes, but I really do want to work for clients that are trying to leave the world in a better place. And therefore we've gravitated to those more third sector organizations or companies not driven necessarily by profit, I would say. So yeah, that's really kind of like an overview of me and my company. And I think mindfulness, by the way, is something in the last 2 or 3 years through various coaches and experiences in my life, I've found not only things like meditation, which are obviously a key part of this sort of mindfulness and well-being, but also just thinking about my working practice, you know, about how many hours I work, about how I interact with people, about how teams that I work with interact with each other, and just being respectful and of not only people and what they want to do and how they want to operate, but also my place in the world. And I think that's where I think there's an interesting thing to discuss now about UX and mindfulness and how they dovetail and very much are part of each other. And the other question is, like, is it just that my version of UX is has ended up becoming mindful because of my personal life, I suppose.
Yeah, I like this thing that you talk about there with the concept of putting the customer, the user, the human, I guess, at the center of everything. And that feels like quite a, well, like a fundamental way of doing good business, and actually of doing good communication with the world, whether you're in business, not for profit, or whether you're actually talking to family and friends. It just feels that to put the other person, their experience of kind of what you're offering, what you're communicating, putting that at the center of everything, just feels like the right thing to do, doesn't it?
Agreed. Yeah. And I think certainly the world, the way the world's changing and evolving at the moment, I think it's almost like something like UX, user experience design, to give its full name, has appeared because of where the world is, because of how, not only how we're interacting with all these digital things now, these experiences that have to be refined and pioneered by, you know, big tech companies to sort of make them better and better and more useful to us. But I think you're right that, you know, whenever you're designing something, it's only for a human, isn't it? It's only used by humans. And I think that traditionally, actually, there was often a lot of technical people involved in creating these tools, these experiences, and they saw it very much from their perspective. So, you know, there were engineers, there were software people, they were managers, they were people trying to get projects done. And often what can happen if you don't apply some UX principles is that you can lose your way. It's a bit like when you see a film that someone spent hundreds of millions of dollars on, but it ends up being a dud. And it's probably because the people within internally have spent so much time focused on the result and what they're building, they forgot about what the user, the person, the human would get. So yeah, I think with UX, there's sort of several, there's some probably phrases, words that people would have come across. So user-centered design is kind of another term that really sums up what UX is. And that is that you're really designing around the user. You're designing around the person, the human that's going to use it. You're putting them at the center of it. Human-centered design, similar thing. I'd say that is almost a nicer phrase, because users is a bit clinical, whereas user-centered design, you're ultimately trying to work out, like, how does a human benefit from this experience if we create it? Design thinking is another term that people may have heard of that's related to UX. That I would probably say is the process we use. So when you're doing user experience, there's all sorts of aspects. And a lot of it is about finding out what the problem is. So the organization that you're working with, they'll come to you often with a solution, but there's a problem driving it. You know, we need more conversions. We're not engaging with our customers properly. We know there's a better way. And so there's the problem aspect of establishing what the problem is. And then there's the user themselves. How do we find out what they need? Do we interview them? Do we look at your existing digital sort of assets and experiences you've got, and how can we analyze them? There's a really, I suppose, really a thing I kind of repeat often is this thing of moving as a designer. Part of the thing about UX that really appealed to me was about moving from a subjective world where it's about my opinion and about whether I think this is the right solution or the client does, to an objective world where we have evidence, or we have, you know, this is what the user said, this is the problem that they highlighted, this is the feedback you got, and therefore let's build with that. There's another phrase which another UX designer in Bristol, Stuart Church, uses, which is that he wants to get inside the brain of someone and then build things with that, which I think is a really nice way of putting something at the heart of UX. One thing that kind of comes out of UX design, I think this is a quite nice bridge into the mindful element, is ethics. So on our course, we actually teach a module on ethics in UX design. And this is about When you build something digital or otherwise, by the way, I think user experience completely way outside of just digital experiences. It could be any interaction with a user or customer. But you are ultimately, in some ways, manipulating what they do. You're giving them a set of tasks to work through, a journey. And it's very easy to make something and not consider what better actually means. So yeah, there's a great quote from Ethics for Designers. So designers are a huge influence on how people behave and live their lives. As designers, we're trained to solve problems and make people's lives better. Rarely do we consider what better actually is. And I think that this is where the ethics part comes in, because you could, for example, there's what called dark patterns, where you could elongate the time that something refreshes on, say, an Instagram feed, so that it releases more dopamine in the user's brain when it eventually refreshes. It's almost like a gambling machine. And those experiences, Instagram being a good example because it's just, you know, nearly a billion users, those little experiences or little elements of what makes it better, I think suddenly have started to be considered from a well-being point of view. Should the user spend lots of time on Instagram and not with their children or engaging with the world? And therefore, what's happened, like from a good pattern point of view, is that Instagram, they brought in things like you're up to date. So when you scroll through your feed now, it'll tell you when you've seen everything you've already seen, which is a step in the direction of getting users away from screens and more back into their lives, rather than engaging them and making a metric of they used it for 5 hours. It's like, well, they shouldn't be. Should they be using it for 5 hours? Is that a good thing? So yeah, I think there was a really good quote I read around ethics and around how we need to be careful with this experience, you know, that we're giving a human. And there was a brilliant quote said, we are humans, that we ultimately have experiences and then we die, which is a very sort of kind of absolute way of looking at it. But that is really what happens. And therefore, we've got to be careful we don't waste people's precious time. This is one experience that they take and use and have. So yeah, I think in conclusion on this aspect of what is UX and also how does it relate to mindfulness, I think that when UX is done well and you are truly considering the humans at the heart of it, and you're using good collaboration, you're engaging with users and stakeholders involved in the project, and you're considering the ethical outcomes, like as in what does better mean, I think then UX is mindful. I think basically with that in mind, we have to be present, we have to absorb, we have to be patient, we have to trust in our process, we have to, lots of these factors to design thinking the UX process ultimately I think are quite mindful in themselves.
I'm starting to really get convinced about this, you know. You know, just the way that you're kind of describing that for me is really, really interesting in terms of this almost move away from it being user experience to being HX. So moving from UX to HX, human experience.
Yeah.
And I think for me, the thing that's making me feel a lot more convinced that this is actually a real thing, this mindful UX, is this whole idea of almost being awake to the changing needs of humans. Because obviously we're going through some fundamental changes as a planet and sort of societies and communities, you know, coming out on the other side in very different sort of shapes and forms. And I think we're all very much awakening to this whole concept that change, as you described it there, you know, we spend time on, you know, experiences and then we die, is the kind of right at the kind of the far end of reality of all of this. But I think for most people, if they do stop and take a breath, and certainly if you're designing something or building or creating something, tangible product, service, and experience, I think to be mindful of the way that you sort of talked about it, you used the word iterations. And I think the fact is that this is an ongoing iterative kind of process that it never stops, does it? Once you begin on this journey and you realize the value that you're adding by taking that human-centric position, there's no going back, is there? Once you're on this road, everything changes and you're always going to be doing this, aren't you?
I think that's a really good way of putting it. And I think you're completely right, but it's a leap of faith to adopt a process like user experience, to really put the customer at the heart of what you're doing. And I think, yeah, you're right. In this world at the moment, we experience, I think, the pandemic and the situation we're in at the moment is quite unique, and arguably no one could really see that coming. But I think we are suffering at the hands of a lot of short-term thinking. And I mean that from like a kind of government level, leadership level, very sort of reactive, short-term, and also a sense of it being done. Often when you work with clients, and it's understandable, this is a kind of human nature, I suppose, we want an idea of when this thing will be finished. And I think one of the reasons that we're really interested in membership organizations, for example, is that they understand that it's never going to be done, that iteration is really key. And I think part of one of the bigger things that's been playing on my mind recently is around responsibility and about admitting that you got things wrong. And there's a sense, and I think it comes from, I think it's maybe a generational thing, but I don't know. It's certainly through leadership and leadership style, of almost like that you don't admit you were wrong, that you don't own up to the issues and the challenges you faced. And one thing that's really interesting in UX is that unless you explore the problem, unless you really unpack what the problem is, what's going wrong properly, it's very difficult to move forward. And if you're iterating, part of iteration is that you have to own up to the fact that the thing you created, the service you created, isn't as effective as it could be. And I think that humans actually are very good at adapting. I think it's our killer feature, being able to adapt. Probably why we're at the top of the food chain. And one thing that's shown me in this last few months, the world changing in such a drastic way, is how quickly I quickly adapted to that. And I think therefore within us is this ability to adapt, this ability to recognize that something has to change, that something isn't working, and that the techniques we used before may not be relevant anymore. I think I read a quote from Jeff Bezos, someone I have deeply some quite big ethical issues with, but on his management style, this was really, really interesting. He said that when he employs someone, he looks for someone who's prepared to change their mind. You know, someone who isn't fit, has a fixed mindset. He wanted to employ people who, you know, one day might come up with a solution and the next day say, you know what, that solution is the wrong way to go. We need to change it. Because if you right now in the current climate, if your fixed mindset in your business, if you decided what your service was and you decided where it's going, and you're not prepared to consider other routes, you're probably going to really suffer. Because if recession hits, if the world has changed, let's face it, even if we go back to normal, whatever that might mean now, it's changed. We've gone through a situation, a door we can't go back through, let's say. And so I think to have that kind of more growth mindset, that more iterative, let's get back to basics, let's consider where we're going, that seems essential now. And I think that's what you're recognizing, that this is, it's almost becoming the norm, or it needs to become the norm, rather than a nice idea.
Yeah, and there's a real honesty going on here then, isn't there? Because as you describe it, this concept of it's only really going to work if you can almost own up to the truth. And yeah. You started off when you first sort of described UX as being, you know, it's the objective view. It's almost like taking that sort of innate subjectivity, which we all have as human beings, almost out of the equation, saying, right, let's base very much on evidence. Let's base this on kind of what we see, not what we're anticipating or perceiving. It's kind of, no, what is the reality here? And then really taking ownership and accountability for it. I think for lots of organizations, that's probably quite a big step when you have particularly larger organizations where you're driven by stakeholder value, you're driven by, you know, the opinions of the board of directors, maybe your boss is pushing for pressure onto you for, you know, particular political gains that they might have or whatever. I think there is a lot of obstruction here. This isn't easy to do, is it?
No, I think you're right. And I think I mentioned earlier on, a leap of faith and also a cultural shift. I think part of what we teach in our course is that there are, if you like, there's a mindset that has to be adopted in order to do UX or to be a UXer, let's say. But I think that goes right down to the organizational level as well. It's one of those things, it's very easy. For example, let's say environmental or CSR approach within business. It's one thing to say that you are going to be more green, more ethical. It's another thing to do it. And I think often what can happen with brands is they get a new logo, they change all their messaging, but actually systemically within their organization, they haven't made that cultural shift. And that actually is really difficult. I think when you're given, like I said, humans are amazing at adapting if we have to. If we don't have to, and if there's a sort of, like you said, stakeholders, shareholders, all sorts of assumed positions or real positions within business that might force you to carry on in a certain way, that makes it very difficult to shift how people operate and how people work. I think that, like I said, in our course, we end up saying that we could teach you hard skills, we could teach you bits of software, but actually that would be a mistake, because really the focusing on the mindset is everything. And I think therefore it's all about the problem. It's all about, like we said, about listening, about really getting under the skin of what the user wants. And I think when with organizations where we are shifting their culture, one of the things that we find really effective is to get in a position where you have some evidence. Often businesses won't record things because then they can't measure it. And I don't know whether that's, you know, something they do on purpose or whether it's just convenient. But as soon as you do, for example, say some user testing, whereby you might take an existing say application or website that they have, and you put it in front of a real user and you get actual feedback from them. If you take the results of those tests, which are usually say a video or audio, and put it in front of a stakeholder, a CEO, and show them what the user's doing, it very quickly changes their mind about whether they should measure things or whether they should listen to their users, because they hear it from their mouth. That it's no longer me trying to convince them or the marketeer trying to convince them. They've seen it with their own eyes. And I think that evidence, that ability to see what the user actually did and actually experienced, is very powerful. But yeah, I came up actually with a sort of mindful UX set of principles, which I was going to talk through if that seemed like a good idea. Just some things, I guess, that maybe listeners could take away and think about when they're doing their business. I think these are quite universal actually as well. I think, come back to your point, I think these are useful in any business, in any kind of business process. So yeah, the first one was about listening. I think that if we're going to adapt to the world and how it's changing, we need to listen. Listening is a really underestimated or undervalued skill, actually, I would say. Active listening is quite difficult. Some people do it naturally, some people can't wait to get to the end, to get to the end of their sentence so they can say the next thing. But I think, listening, and that, by that I mean listening to users, I mean listening to people, other people in your organization. There are ideas that can come from anywhere. The other one is about being open-minded and emphatic. I think we have to think about, we have to be open to new processes and new ways of thinking, but we also need to use empathy, a big part of UX, and I think a huge part of mindfulness and therefore someone's well-being is empathy. What is that other human thinking? What set of problems are going on in their mind? And how can I relate to them? And I think when you do that, when you use empathy in particular, your approach to an experience or a product or a service will change drastically, because you will immediately then be thinking, well, of course we have to consult with them. We have to get under their skin. We have to understand what their problem is in order to help solve this. If we don't, how are we going to know if we solved their problem? And so, yeah, listening and empathy, obviously very closely linked. The next one is problem first. So this is about parking solutions. We often have like a solution swear jar. You know, if you're in the early stages of a project and someone comes up with a solution, we almost, you know, say that they have to put some money in a jar, you know, because really we want to focus on lots of businesses don't like doing this, but it's so essential to get to the bottom of what the real pain is. What's the pain of the business? You know, is it hemorrhaging money? Is it losing users? Is there politics and you know, cultural shift and change going on that needs to be tackled? And I think there's a really great quote from Albert Einstein. It's, if I only had 1 hour to solve a problem, I would spend 55 minutes defining the problem. And basically what he's saying there is like, if you spend your time establishing what actually is going on and what you really need to solve, what the pain that sits behind it, you're not going to need long then to come up with a solution. The solution will probably even present itself. But the more you spend time defining it, researching it, talking about it, the more likely you are to come to the correct solution. Versus, I think, if you come with a solution, you can become very fixated on it, even if it's not the right one. The next one was about being responsible. And I think this is a huge part. We touched on this earlier on. We're in a world where short-term thinking and not owning up to your part that you play in something going wrong. And I would not to go into to make this political, but I think our political climate at the moment has a lot of these issues, that if the government were prepared to say that they got something wrong and that they're exploring new ideas, I don't think that would be met with horror. I think it would display empathy. It would display, oh, they're all human. You know, they're politicians are human. CEOs are human. They all make mistakes. I think everyone does. And we're in a situation at the moment, case in point with the current pandemic, is that this is unknown territory. No one knows what to do necessarily. It's okay for that to be the case. So with regards to that being responsible, I think it's about having those difficult conversations in the context of a project. It's about getting the client to think about maybe even, you know, the impact they're going to have on the world. So if we're being mindful, that needs to bleed into the well-being of the user and the staff and the people who are going to run this service. So I think being responsible for not only the mistakes you've made or the problem at the heart of this, but also that bleeds into being responsible for the well-being of the humans that will use and interact with this service. The next one, a phrase that we say an awful lot, is you are not your user. Often we can approach a problem, and this is, I think, human nature, that we want to make assumptions, we want to move to solutions, we want to start designing, start creating, start building. But we have to remember, I think, that unless we consult with the user, the humans that use this, and do our research, how are we going to balance the needs of both the organization and us as the solution makers, let's say, with the actual problem that the user has, the issue they have? You know, is this, we think all the button placement and the flow of our app is perfect because it follows conventions and we've done this 100 times, but actually when a user uses it, they think in a very different way. Their priorities are very different. They ultimately want to get something done and leave. They're not standing around admiring the you know, smelling the roses and admiring your beautiful designs. They just want to get something done. So I think there's a really good principle. You are not your user, remember that. And so therefore that leads back to listening, empathy, problem first, being responsible. There was another nice quote from Robert Half that we use in our course a lot. When the customer comes first, the customer will last, which I think is a really nice way of saying, you know, particularly in the frame of iteration and ongoing improvement, that if you put them at the heart, they'll stay. Well-being of your team is the last sort of point or part of this sort of mindful design principles that I've been thinking about, is that obviously there's the user and that you're creating for and the human that will use this experience, but there's also the team that will create it. And I think that in the context of mindfulness, that's very important, because it can be very easy for projects, particularly very complex big projects, and I think digital, film, games, all these very, very complex digital experiences, you often hear about long working hours, some sort of negative or destructive, let's say, culture that exists within that company. So they're creating something beautiful, amazing, great, but actually at what cost to the people who create it and work within that organization? So I think a lot of, I think why UX is a process, let's say. It's not necessarily a deliverable. It's often a process more than anything. It's a way of creating things. And therefore, I think that the well-being of the team that creates it needs to be considered. So, you know, flexible working, something very pertinent to the world right now, shorter hours, more agile, lean methods, great communication, looking at how you work remotely more effectively. Just being conscious of all the people and how they're interacting and taking on pressures and responsibilities within a project.
Yeah, the thing that's really resonating, I think, for me at the moment is this kind of balance, is a mix of a few words that you've said, I think probably sort of two or three times there, that are really kind of, for me, coming together and balancing what I think is just really, really great business practice, really great human practice, really. And it's almost, this is why I'm even more convinced now, and I'm getting increasingly convinced that there is this thing, mindful UX, because for me, it's about this patience. It's about listening. It's about the empathy. It's about balance. It just feels that there's a real kind of honesty behind all of this, is that if people are designing things, be it products, digital experience, a community, because I think this does play out in terms of, you know, how people actually in the real world, you know, build new friendships, for example, all of this stuff feels like these are some of the innate best ways that you can operate as a human being. So whilst we've kind of made an industry that supports marketing and customer support and, you know, the shape of businesses, it feels like there's something that's really, really back to the roots of who we are as individuals, you know, respecting others, listening to others, being accountable and responsible, being patient, showing empathy. All these things sort of seem to come out in UX, don't they? They're just, it's almost like this is the focal point for them all in a kind of a design sense.
Yeah, I agree. I think, again, I don't know how much of my own personal view of the world and experience of it, and certainly my ethics and morals and things, bleed into my practice. I'm sure that there are variations in how UX is done, but I agree with you on the whole that I think that those values that sit at the heart of most humans, no matter what your, say, political leanings are or any of those things, most humans do want respect, and they respect the people in their lives that mean something to them or that they chime with. And I think, yeah, I think that UX maybe is mirroring that need to get back to or remember that we're humans, that we're sensitive souls, that we do have needs, and quite complex needs, but also very basic needs too. You know, I haven't got much time, or particularly now, you know, I'm in my house a lot, and I have to be conscious of my well-being even more so, actually, because it'd be very easy for me to not go outside today, or it'd be very easy for me to not interact with someone. And there are very basic needs, aren't there? And I mean beyond, you know, food and water. I mean just we're social creatures. And I think with that in mind, you mentioned the word community there. I think communities are something that in the world are going to become and are becoming much, much more important. I think we're redefining how communities work. And I think in this sort of post-COVID world, how we think about communities is going to change. You know, you mentioned something like, I don't know, dating, for example. How do you do dating in a world where you can't meet up with someone, or you can't be more, you have to be more than 2 meters away? Suddenly these online experiences become critical, these ways of interacting, these ways of building communities online, which then bleed out into physical communities, undoubtedly have to behave in probably a slightly different way than they used to. But yeah, I do think there's something very innate and deeply human at the heart of UX and what it means, certainly my version of it.
So you've touched on the future and kind of post-COVID and kind of how things might look in the not too distant sort of horizon that we see coming at us. I mean, what are your views? Where do you think, if there is this thing, mindful UX, mindful HX, now as I think we're starting to feel it might be, because there's a lot of crossover here, where do you think things are going to go? What's your vision of the future for HX, UX?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's something actually I've spent certainly recently a lot of bit of time thinking about it. And we're actually in the process of thinking about where our business goes. You know, I think this point in time it's a great time to be reflective and think about what you're doing and where you've gone, where it's going. Some of the things that I think are really critical are, and this is a thing that's arisen and certainly with mobile devices in the last few years, is about limiting screen time. We've become very screen orientated, and that's something we just have to accept. That's the way the world works now. But I think we, particularly when you're stuck inside all day, you've got to make sure that you don't just look at a screen or go from one screen to another, or there's dual screening and triple screening. You know, you watch TV with your laptop on your lap and your phone in your hand. So I think we have to, some of the ways we can do that is, and that I think what that leads to, by the way, is a lot of stress and anxiety often, if people don't limit their time on screens or become overloaded with notifications and communications. I think we need to make things easier. So I think that's one of the key things. If tasks are easier to achieve, we get them done quicker, we put our phone down and we don't need it anymore. I think reducing cognitive load, this is a term that you mentioned you heard a lot recently. This is this idea, there's a term in UX, don't make me think, a very good book actually, really worth looking up, probably some of the sort of fundamentals of user experience, are that you need to reduce the load you put on people's brains. You need to stop bombarding them with messages. You need to make this this process and this experience easier for them, so that we don't overload humans. At the moment, we're all, a lot of us are working at home, most of us, and actually that would seem like kind of a mindful space to be, but actually we often, what can happen is that we then get stressed out because we've got so much communication going on. You know, everyone's having 100 Zoom calls with their family at the moment. Well, that didn't happen before. That's a huge cognitive load, actually. I think use of good patterns too. I touched on that earlier on. We need to explore conventions that make sense, and the definition of better. A good pattern is something that spurs and gets a user doing good behavior or looking after their well-being. Or, you know, I just got a wearable, like a new watch that looks like a normal watch, but it counts my steps. So I'm not gazing at a screen all day. It looks like a watch. That to me feels like a really positive step in that direction. That's a positive pattern for me. So I think we need to define and use positive patterns or good patterns. The next one is around that I've been thinking about is culture. And we've touched on this earlier on. I think this is really critical, is the ways we work together. Because if we work together in a good way and we're mindful of each other and there's these certain elements to that, we'll create better experiences. We'll be more likely to listen and be empathetic with our users. So think things like, I'd say, conscious collaboration. That's a term I heard this week. So that is like, you know, when you're collaborating with someone or a team, you're thinking about their time and about taking it up. That means that let's not have a 4-hour meeting. Let's stick to 10 minutes. Can we do this in 10 minutes? Can we have one meeting now and one later on if we need to, rather than, I know some people who are literally having 8 hours of Zoom calls a day at the moment. Well, that's not good for us. That's not a good thing. That leads to trust, actually. I think that we need to trust our employees. I think one of the things that, in a more remote world, a lot of culture in business is about bums on seats and about knowing where people are. And if you don't know where they are, if they're not on the Zoom call, then they're not working. And I think we really need to change that. I come from a very small team, so it's easier for me to say and do. But I think that there needs to be that shift in culture to take care of our team members. We need to listen to team members. We need to be open to new ways of working. And I think that therefore things like trust and conscious collaboration really are key there. So one of the other aspects is interface itself. You know, I talked about limiting screen time and about that watch that I've got, which again in turn limits my screen time. There are lots of other kind of ways of interacting with things that are appearing that are very, very much in their infancy. Voice is one. I have lots of arguments with my Google Assistant, but it's come a long way. It's now very helpful. It turns on my lights. It reduces my interaction with certain things. Not that I'm afraid of turning a light switch on, but I can now turn all of them on in one fell swoop. Wearables, like I mentioned, looking at how other sensors and things that interact with our senses can be used. And I think an extension to that, we're going to find now in this new world that what some of my thoughts are that we've kind of been in the middle of the fourth industrial revolution, I think they say, for some time now. And I think that what happens when you get into world-changing events or war, which you could argue we're in the middle of a war of sorts, that's when these things are accelerated. That's when change is very much accelerated. That's when revolutions are able to happen. And I think things like AI and machine learning and how that predicts our behavior and where we're going, again, a huge ethical dilemma in there about what should be allowed, what should be used, where it should go. And when you think of mindfulness and UX and start factoring in things like machine learning and AI, you've got an awful lot of things to solve, an awful lot of problems to consider. And then also things like cryptocurrency and the new digital ways of doing things. We're suddenly going to find that things like, currency, universal basic income, all these things that a few years ago were laughed at and ridiculed for being idealistic are suddenly actually becoming a reality. And that's a very, very strange world. It's a very interesting from my perspective. But yeah, I think we need to consider how these new interfaces, new technologies can be used, because now actually we're ready. We're ready to use them. We have a reason to use them. Then, I suppose the other thing is around, that's been playing on my mind, is about how we allow users to make better decisions, to help them make better decisions. Thing that strikes me at the moment is that in the current climate, we're very reliant on quite traditional methods of news and an interaction with our, say, government, for example. You know, we're waiting for this conversation. Very, very recently, I received a letter from the Prime Minister. Now, that letter was talked about, and then it took 3 or 4 days to arrive. And by the time the letter arrived, the news within it, the sentiment within it, was out of date. Now, the amount of time, effort, money, and et cetera, involved in that was unbelievable. And imagine if we had, you know, these devices in our pockets that everyone had, that we could communicate with. it staggers me that the government haven't embraced, and I would say big organizations as well, aren't embracing that ability to communicate with users more effectively. And I think, again, we're in this world where that's accelerating. So GovTech is a term that's come up, which is really about how we revolutionize and overhaul some of these very, very draconian and old-fashioned methods of democracy, like voting, like referendums, decision-making, alerting users to things that are happening and changing. Imagine if you were asked a question a day rather than a question at one point of the year that changed our entire future. I think those are all things we need to consider. And if we get them right, they'll empower users. Our societal structure will really hugely benefit from us embracing and using those really powerful bits of technology correctly to help democracy. I think it's kind of working against us a bit at the moment. The last point I had about the future is that UX isn't just a digital buzzword. I think that we've explored today that whereas UX or user experience started out as this new way of doing things, I think my ultimate goal is that UX just becomes the way we do things. My view is that when UX isn't talked about anymore, it's just the way we make things, then I've done my job. You know, you saying that this sort of fundamentally human aspect to how UX is, openness, iteration, trust, respect. Wouldn't it be great if that became the norm? And why isn't it the norm? And so I think, yeah, those principles I talked about, I think cultural shift within organizations, if those things happen and they're embraced, I think everyone will be happier. That's my view anyway.
This is fascinating stuff, isn't it? There's obviously, you know, a huge amount of options and ideas and thinking in there. If somebody has got to the point of listening to this thinking, you know, actually now is the time I really need to get my organization on board. We need to take that kind of time out to think about things, in particular, I guess, if they are in sort of third sector, nonprofit or membership organization, and they want to find out more and get a bit of support. How best to contact you?
Well, I mean, I'm always happy to have a conversation. Deckchair.co.uk is my website. You can also Google Ollie Francis and I'll come up on various networks and things. And yeah, I really am open. This isn't at all a hard sell at all. I'm really open to conversations. I'm really interested in how this world develops. And I think that's first step is really critical. I think there are actually quite a lot of free resources out there, some really great books. I mentioned one, Don't Make Me Think, but there are some others that are floating around that really, I think, allow someone to get the basics of what user experience is very quickly. We also do, on occasion, free talks. We're looking at things like webinars that we can do, which get across some of these basics, because it's, as I said, this isn't just a marketing ploy. Me and Rebecca Taylor, who I work with closely, we sort of firmly believe that if we don't get some of these basic principles of UX within the culture of most organizations, that we're going to continue to create bad experiences as a whole, as a country, as a world. So yeah, feel free to contact me on various social media outlets and through my website just to have a chat. And also what I'll try and do is in this whole mindful UX vein, I'm thinking about a series of blogs in that nature about how to embrace it, how to get started with it, what those principles are.
So Ollie Francis from Deckchair, thank you so much for your time today.
Real pleasure, Neil. Thank you for inviting me on. And as I said, anybody wants to get in touch, feel free to do that. And good luck.